Welcome back to Stack Trace, a show where we talk about Apple news and rumors from a developer's perspective. I am John Sundell, and I'm joined by my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Guy?
Hi, John. Doing great here.
Awesome. I hear that you're getting summer in Brazil. Is that right?
That's true. It's currently 28 degrees outside.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good temperature. It's going the opposite direction here, but, you know, that's just the way the earth spins. So what have you been up to lately?
Oh, I totally forgot that I was supposed to say that I went to the Swift Alps conference.
Oh, yeah, of course. How was that?
Oh, it was great. It's they call it an experimental format, but I guess the experiment was successful because yeah, it's really cool. It's a small conference, so they invite, like, I think there were like 8 mentors. So we do workshops with at most 10 people per workshop, and we do 3 sessions per day. So it was really fun, and I got to meet lots of cool people and do a workshop on reverse engineering and spelunking private APIs, which was fun.
Yeah, that sounds really, really cool. Because like you mentioned, it's such a small conference, and you're just like 50 people or something stuck together in like a small village in the Alps of Switzerland. So there's nothing really, there are no distractions. There's nothing else to do besides the conference, which is, you know, in this case, really great because you get to really spend a lot of time with a lot of people and, you know, hang out and hack on stuff and, of course, have all the workshops. And yeah, I was there last year also as a mentor. I did a game jam there at Swift Alps. That was a lot of fun. So yeah, bummed I couldn't go this year, but, you know, there were so many other conferences to go to. So it was hard for me to kind of fit that in.
You also get to eat lots of cheese. And it was cold there.
Oh, yeah, it was?
Yeah, more cold than I've ever experienced.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, you brought your winter jacket?
Definitely, and it was worth it because there was a day which was, I think, -2 outside, something like that. And it snowed as well, which was fun.
I can tell that you haven't been in winter weather a lot in your life because you call it -2. No one ever says -2. We say -2, right?
For me, it's negative because I hate the cold.
All right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, but it was fine. I survived.
Oh, that's great. It's a great experience. So besides your recent adventures in Switzerland, I hear that you've been back spelunking some new stuff.
Yes, so there are new betas out. I thought they would stop by this time of year, but Apple's still going, so they're still releasing betas. And they also released 5.1.2 of watchOS with EKG support.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a look, and there was this interesting icon for a new smart battery case.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw you post that. Yeah, that's really cool. And do you think this is a kind of product that's going to come out pretty soon? Do you think, you know, in time now for the holidays? Or do you think it's more like a 2019 kind of thing?
It's fun that you ask because there's an identifier that calls that type of smart battery case, Smart Battery Case 2018.
Oh, so, wow. Okay.
So it's supposed to come out this year. Maybe it was supposed to come out this year, but didn't make it. But there's still time. There's precedent. Apple has released accessories like, I think, AirPods were released in like December 19th or something. So
yeah,
there's precedent for it. So we could still see the new smart battery case and that would be for the new models like the 10S, 10S Max, and 10R. And there are 3 different models of the new smart battery case. So I guess we would see it for all 3 sizes of iPhone.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's going to be really interesting to see like what the weight will be on, for example, the 10S Max, because that battery case was quite heavy, like the old one for the... It came out along the iPhone 7, iPhone 7 Plus, something like that, right?
I think it came out for the iPhone 7, but it supported the iPhone 6S and the iPhone 7. And
right,
there's never been a version for the Plus model. So it was
the
quote-unquote small phone.
Right. Yeah, so imagine like the weight on the XS with that battery case, because, you know, that phone is already quite heavy, and it would be really interesting to see, you know, would you need to like carry it in a separate bag or something in order to actually bring it with you?
Yes, it looks like it would be a little bit thinner on the battery, but also not have the chin at the bottom, so the battery would extend all the way to the bottom. Yeah. And there's some speculation that this could be so it would sit well on a wireless charger. So maybe the battery would support wireless charging as well. Maybe they were planning to release it with air power.
Yeah, it seems like air power, you know, is kind of holding up a lot of different products. Like there was talk about the AirPods wireless charging case, now this and other things. And it seems like air power was supposed to be this thing that they all worked with, right? But it's kind of delayed. So yeah, it's really, really funny to see these things.
Yeah, so there you go. Let's see when they finally release it.
Yeah, absolutely. And what kind of software support have you seen? Like, what kind of support is required in the OS for a new battery case? Like, because I assume they use some kind of non-standard ways to kind of hook it onto the phone, or does it all kind of go through the Lightning port, or, you know, how does all that kind of work?
I don't see any new software support other than the icons. So right. Apple always wants to represent the devices on the UI as they are in real life. So since the new battery case looks different than the old one, they want that to appear in the software. So they have pretty realistic renders of this new smart battery case. Or maybe they are pictures, as we learned.
Yeah, which you are very happy about, I know, because that's like, that's your perfect spelunking target, is those icons and those images.
Yes, I love them. So what have you been doing?
So I am currently in full preparation to go kind of full indie, if you will. So for the last 2 years, I've been working as a freelancer, pretty much like 80% of my time. And then 20% of my time I've spent, you know, running Swift by Sundell, doing things like this podcast, working on open source and things for the community. And I've really, really enjoyed these 2 years, like starting to work more with these kind of things, like content production, working for the community, being more active online and things like that. And now I want to take it a step further. So starting January 1st, I'm going to make kind of this show, Swift by Sundell, all of my community work, that's going to be my main job. So I'm pretty much like flipping those two numbers. So I'm going to do like 80% working with this kind of stuff. And then 20%, I'm still going to do some freelancing on the side. So that's going to be very exciting. It's exciting. It's scary. It's going to be fun. So in preparation for that, one of my main sources of income, or pretty much my main source of income starting next year, will be sponsorships. And I run sponsorships on Swift by Sundell. I've been doing it on the podcast now for quite a while. And I just launched yesterday as we record my new sponsorship program for 2019, which includes also being able to sponsor my blog for the first time. And this is something that I've been working a lot on. Like I spend a lot of time working on this because, you know, I really don't like web ads. I think most people don't. It's, you know, you go to a website, you get pop-ups, you get ads, you get banners, you get these things tracking you everywhere. So you see the same, you know, flight or pair of jeans on 100 different websites. You know, I hate that stuff. So I wanted to build like really nice looking, elegant ads that wouldn't track you. That are simple text-based ads. And that's what I did. So starting next year, companies, they can advertise on my website, but in a very nice way that respects user privacy, that is not invasive, no pop-ups or ad banners or flashing images. Fits in very well with the content. And yeah, I'm incredibly excited about that. And I think I've managed to build something that I think is a win for everybody, win for the reader, for the advertiser, and also for me being able to keep doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, when you showed to me how ads would work on your website, I told you that I thought it was really nice. And so the visual aspect was already sorted out. But then there's this whole tracking aspect, which some people might say, oh, but if you don't have tracking, then no one's going to want to do ads on your website. But that's not true. Like the people who would require ads to do the ad on your website, require the tracking, those are the people you don't want to work with.
So maybe yeah, pretty much.
It's a win-win situation.
Yeah, absolutely. It does require a lot more work on my part. I mean, the easiest thing to do would be to either A, just put, you know, some big ad SDK on the website that would serve banner ads and do all this scary tracking and everything, and just, you know, not look at that and imagine it doesn't exist and just take the money. That would be one easy option. And then the second easy option would be to just say, okay, well, I'm just going to make every fourth article free. And then the rest of those three articles every month, they're going to be paid. So there's going to be a paywall and you can only read one article a month or otherwise you have to pay me. And neither one of these two options really appeal to me because I really don't like ad tracking. I do not want to embed any of these ad SDKs on my site. And I also don't want to have these ugly banner ads or things cluttering up my articles. And also, I don't want my articles to be hidden behind a paywall, because one thing I've really enjoyed doing this site is just how many people I can connect with in the community, and just hearing from so many people that read my articles and like them and things like that and shares them with other people. And I feel like a lot of that would be lost if I just, you know, put everything behind a paywall. So I think with this option, it does require me to like do a lot more sales and talk to sponsors, you know, find relevant companies that are interested in sponsoring this specific thing and things like that. But I think it's going to be worth it because the user experience is going to be so much better. And I think the sponsors I do end up getting and working with are usually like a great fit, and I can continue working with them for a long time, like I have with some of my current sponsors on the podcast.
Yeah, that's awesome. And the ads look really good, and they don't, they are not distracting. And that's also good for the company that's doing the ad, because then the user doesn't like automatically skip over the ad.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it needs to be like a win-win, really. Like for the user to want to, you know, click on the ad or be interested in the content of it, it needs to look good, it needs to, you know, be relevant, and it needs to be nice. And the same goes from the sponsor's point of view. Like they also obviously want people to engage with the thing that they're promoting. And, you know, for that, it also needs to be nice and fitting in. So I feel like doing it this way has a really big potential for being like a really nice fit for everybody. So, yeah, I'm excited about it. And if you're listening to the show and you know of a company that would be a good fit for sponsoring Swift by Sundell, it can be, you know, if you work for a company that makes a developer tool, or you're hiring in your company or something like that, then feel free to go to swiftbysundell.com/sponsor to check out my new page there and, you know, get in touch if you want to help support my work.
Awesome.
All right, awesome. So we're going to start with some follow-up. And we got a really nice email here from a guy named John. And, you know, that's a great name, right?
Wasn't you, right?
It wasn't me. I didn't email ourselves. And he was he has some follow-up about our discussion from the previous episode about, you know, iPad apps and how iPad apps can kind of fulfill their, you know, complete potential. And one thing he said was that one issue lurking underneath a lot of these discussions about iPad apps is the discoverability of features. Either things are hidden away or the screen is cluttered up with buttons. And this is something that the Mac solved, you know, ever since the beginning with the menu bar. You know, you can put all sorts of things in there and it's still discoverable and completely organized. And he's, you know, talking a little bit about, you know, would it make sense for iOS to gain a similar feature? And maybe something like you take five fingers, you put them on the screen, and you see some kind of menu bar. And I think this was a really interesting idea. And one thing that I've really enjoyed recently on my iPad Pro with an external keyboard is keyboard shortcuts. And the way keyboard shortcuts are implemented on iOS, I think, is very, very nice, where, you know, you register keyboard shortcuts with the system, and then you can hold the command key on the keyboard and you see all the keyboard shortcuts that are available for that app. And that got me thinking along those lines, like maybe something where you register some commands and then the system can show them to the user in kind of a uniform way. What do you think about that, Rambo?
Yeah, I think that could work. And the way shortcuts work on iPad, I really like the way they work as well. And yeah, it's discoverable, but I also really love the menu bar on the Mac.
Yeah.
And by the way, a quick pro tip here for the people listening. You can press Command slash on your keyboard, Command Shift slash on your keyboard. So basically, Command Shift and the question mark key on your keyboard. And it's going to highlight the help menu item, and you can start typing the name of a command you want to do, and it's going to find the command in the menu bar. That's
yeah.
a pro tip there for
Yeah, that's a really good pro tip. It's almost like local spotlight for that app.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
I use it all the time. It's so nice.
Yeah, and many people don't know about this. And I was showing it to a colleague a couple of months ago, and he was like, oh my God, this changed my life.
Yeah, it changes everything. Especially yeah. in apps that have a lot of controls, like something like Xcode, or I use it a lot in Pixelmator, because the UI for Pixelmator is all these panels where you have your colors and your layers and all those kind of things. And, you know, sometimes I don't remember the keyboard shortcut, so I just type like colors and it will highlight show colors, and I just press enter and it just, boom, does the thing. So yeah, it's a really good tip. I couldn't live without it at this point.
Yeah, and I really think John found the issue there, which is discoverability of features. And remember we were talking, I don't remember if it was in the last episode that I mentioned, a problem I have with many iOS apps is that I can't find anything. I mentioned, I think, Pixelmator as an example, which like there's nothing on the screen and I don't know how to do anything and I can't find things. Because it's all hidden and you have to learn gestures which are not discoverable. So yeah, that's a big problem. And I think having a more universal way of accessing these features would be beneficial to the platform.
Yeah, absolutely. The universal thing there is really key, because that way the user can learn it once and then you know that it works on every single app, you know, or most apps at least. And again, coming back to my comparison to how keyboard shortcuts work, you know, I know now that if I'm in a new app and I want to see what keyboard shortcuts are available, I just hold the command key and I see them in this nice panel UI. And I think that is extremely powerful, because I found myself using keyboard shortcuts so much more on the iPad just because of this feature, because I don't have to, you know, go myself and try to figure out what keyboard shortcuts are available. I just, you know, press this button and they're there. And I think something similar could allow apps like, you know, you say Pixelmator, and there are a lot of others that have this more minimalistic UI. And you could go even further with that if you knew that there was this kind of escape hatch, right? Where the user says, you know, I don't know what's going on here. Let me just, you know, for example, touch five fingers on the screen and see everything that's available, and I know that's always going to work in all apps. I think that could be very powerful and liberating in terms of, you know, how we design these apps.
There's also this entire accessibility API on iOS, which I learned more about during Swift Alps with a great workshop about accessibility. So maybe they could do something like you press a keyboard shortcut and you start typing, and it's going to highlight on screen where the thing you're typing is. So it doesn't have to be like a menu. It can be like a button or a hidden sheet that you can reveal with a gesture. And the app developer could associate keywords or a description with elements using the responder chain.
Yeah, that would be really cool. I think the fact that the responder chain exists and, you know, just how powerful it is something that could really be utilized for a lot of these features. And it's already used by so many things like, you know, input focus and accessibility, like you mentioned, and things like that. And even things like adjusting scroll views in view controllers and things like that, like adjusting the content inset. And I think that could be really cool for something like this as well. You could just annotate your views and say, here's this control, here's that control. And then you could have like a unified system, or, you know, even something like you pull down from the top and there's a menu bar there, and you could see all of those commands there. You could easily access them that way.
Yes. And thank you, John, for the amazing email, because it made us think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and we love getting follow-up like this. So if you ever have something that you'd like us to, you know, think about, or you want to tell us, feel free to get in touch, you know, either via email or Twitter or whichever channel that you prefer. All right, next up, I want to talk a little bit more about the iPad. And I know, Rambo, you're getting a little bit tired of hearing me talk about the iPad, right?
But it's always the iPad.
It's always the iPad. You know, I've become one of these iPad people now, always talking about the iPad. But, you know, you have to cut me some slack, because as you might know, this is my first iPad since the iPad 3. So a lot of these things are new to me and I'm very, very excited about them. So I got the Smart Keyboard Folio just a couple of days ago
That's nice.
Yeah.
And expensive.
And expensive, yes. And heavy, like way heavier than I thought it was going to be.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, now it like weighs as much as my laptop, which is funny. Like my pro iPad weighs as much as my non-pro laptop. Isn't that funny?
That's very funny.
So, KeyBoardFolio, just very quick review. I think this is an amazing product. And I'm kind of just, why didn't I buy this day one? And the reason I didn't was because, you know, I didn't have an iPad for so long, so I didn't know, you know, how I would use this keyboard or how I would use the device. So I just got the iPad in the beginning, but then after, you know, a week or so, I was like, okay, I'm going to order the smart keyboard as well.
It's very interesting, John, because I have the same thing, and it happened to me with the previous generation of the iPad Pro.
Oh, yeah?
Where I got the iPad and I got the Apple Pencil, and I didn't get the smart keyboard. And like a couple of weeks later, I was like, okay, I want to get the smart keyboard. And I got the smart keyboard. And then, oh, I'm using the iPad 10 times more because I have the keyboard now.
Yeah, it literally yeah. is like that. Like, I've been using the iPad so much more. And I was already using it quite a lot. But it always felt like I was just using it because I wanted to. Now I'm using it because it is actually a better tool for a lot of these things. So, I love the fact that how it clips onto the iPad. Like, it's all magnetic, which makes it super easy to take it off, which is great for me because I don't want to have like this big bulky case when I'm like using the iPad to watch a movie or something. So I take it off all the time and it works really well like that. And the keys also for me is like surprisingly good. Like, I kind of had low expectations because I thought the keys would be, you know, bad, you know, not have any travel, be very, you know, hard to type on. But it's surprisingly good. It feels really nice. And yeah, I've been just really productive with this keyboard because, you know, just having this keyboard attached to the iPad at all times, you know, except when I'm watching a movie, just makes it so much easier to just like look at the iPad because it has Face ID. You know, I get a message from you, for example. I just look at the iPad, I just touch that message and boom, I can just start typing. And that is even faster than me like going to my Mac, launching iMessages on the Mac, typing. You know, it just feels so much more, you know, fluid and fast to use the device with a keyboard.
Yeah, that's true. And you can also play around with Swift Playgrounds and do stuff in Shortcuts or JSBox, Scriptable, Pythonista. Anything that you have to write a lot, having the keyboard makes a ton of difference, especially if it's cold.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was already connecting my Magic Keyboard to the iPad, but just again, having it attached and always there is so much more easy. And it's just so much quicker to just get started with something, like whether it's just typing a note or doing some quick coding, or I've been also been using Swift Playgrounds to do some actual like UI development because I've been building some smaller components this week. And it's, you know, all been done on the iPad. It's been really, really great. And I've also been using this as a little bit of a productivity experiment because, as you know, Rambo, I'm a bit of a productivity nerd.
Yes.
And I love to figure out new ways to get more productive. And one thing I've been doing this past week since I got the keyboard was to say, on the iPad, I'm going to do all my email, all my messaging. You know, I'm going to do all of my kind of just business stuff like invoicing and all those kind of things on the iPad with the keyboard. And then on my computer, I'm just going to do coding. And that has worked really well because for me, you know, just separating those things, like either I'm in like email messaging mode or I'm in coding mode, just being able to kind of segment those things in my brain has worked so well. And as you know, it makes me feel even more productive and more focused when I'm working.
Yeah, that definitely. I've tried it before with Slack, not only for productivity reasons, but also for memory usage and CPU usage reasons.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like having the iPad to the side with the with Slack running without having Slack running on my Mac. And it is good. Yeah, it can be a productivity boost. And you can just, if you want to, you can just put it in do not disturb mode, shut off the screen, and it's peace.
Yeah, exactly. And just like taking that time to say, okay, now I'm going to switch over to this other device, put myself in this other mindset, and just like be productive, you know, replying to people, you know, sending emails and those kind of things. It's also great because a lot of the times what I will do is that I will start working on an email, you know, let's say I have to email some client and it's a bit longer. And then I come up with this code idea and then I just jump to Swift Playgrounds and I start coding because that's fun, right? And then I get all distracted. So just having these separate devices for these two separate tasks, I feel is really nice, at least for me.
Yeah, but another thing that happened is I've noticed you've been using Screen Time as well. What's the deal with that?
Yeah, so again, part of being a productivity nerd is that I really like to figure out where I'm using my time and how. And screen time has been awesome for this because I've been tracking my time now with screen time since iOS 12 came out. And I've been constantly trying to, you know, get my phone usage down, especially like spending time on Twitter and things like that. And I've been tracking it week by week, and each week you get this report, and I've been always trying to reduce the amount of time I spend on the phone and just the amount of pickups and distractions. So now, since I started, I've actually reduced my phone time by over 30%, which is great because that's 30% of my time on my, which was previously used on my phone. I can now spend that, you know, either relaxing, you know, hanging out with friends, or just creating stuff and working and building things instead of, you know, just kind of being idle on my phone.
What's been the most time spent on any given app on your phone? Like, which app was the culprit?
Oh, it's Twitter by far. Like, my screen time looks really, really funny because it's literally just like Twitter, iMessage, Mail, Safari, and then a couple of games. That's it. Like, that's all I use my phone for. It's like, if you built me a smartphone, which wouldn't even be like a proper smartphone, but it would just have like Twitter, iMessage, you know, web browser, and email. Like, that's all I need.
Like the first iPhone.
Yeah, pretty much. I can go back to the first iPhone. If Twitter still runs on it, that is. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not using screen time at the moment, but I want to make a deal here. Let's make a new year's resolution, but a new year's goal.
Okay.
I am going to use screen time. I'm going to enable it today.
Okay.
And on the next episode, which is going to be a while from now, I'm going to say what happened.
Okay. All right. That's going to be
cool. I'm enabling it right now as we speak.
Okay, great. But I think in order for it to be a goal, you need to actually have a goal, right? You need to say, like, how much do you want to reduce your screen time?
Let's say 20%.
That's quite an aggressive goal. 20%? Are you going to be like one of those people, Rambo, that buys a gym card after New Year's and then doesn't go to the gym?
No, I'm not. So I'm going to use the first week as a baseline to actually gather the data, and then we'll see what happens.
Okay, cool. Yeah, if you do even 10%, I think that's going to be cool. For me, like, I could do 30, but that was because I've been really, really actively working on it. So if you do that, I guess you could get 20 or 30 even also.
Oh, yeah. So let's see what happens.
Excellent. So now we've been talking about avoiding screens. Let's now talk about not avoiding screens and actually having them even accessible on our wrists. And of course, we're talking about the Apple Watch. And you have the new Apple Watch, the Apple Watch Series 4. So tell us all about it. What's it like to use the new Apple Watch? And, you know, I know also that you've had a little bit of a story about how you got it and you lost it and you got it again. So, yeah, tell us all about that.
Yeah, I have my second Series 4 Apple Watch on my wrist right now. Because, as people know, I've been to the US, visited Silicon Valley and went to Apple Park and Infinite Loop and all the cool stuff. One of the things I did while in the US is I bought myself a Series 4 Apple Watch. And I wanted the stainless steel version, so I got the LTE one, which is the only one that has the stainless steel option. Okay, so that's Apple Watch Series 4 number one.
Uh-huh.
And then Apple released, was it 5.1, I think? Anyway, they released a botched update for the Apple Watch, for watchOS, and it killed my Apple Watch.
Yeah.
And I was in Brazil at that time. And they won't exchange US Apple Watch with LTE here. If it was just a GPS one, they would I could bring it to the Apple Store and they would just give me a new one.
And that's because they don't sell the LTE version in Brazil, right?
They do, but it's a different model.
Oh, right. Because different carriers, different signal technologies, things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I got another one.
So you bought another one, or they replaced it for you, or
no? They can't. They won't replace it.
Okay, so you just said I'm gonna bite this bullet and I'm actually gonna just buy anyone.
Yeah, yeah. So the goal is to exchange my Series 4 LTE next year when I'm in the US again. So
okay,
that's what I'm going to do. So it's not completely lost. It's just it's just there like it's gold or something, storing value for me and losing value.
It's an investment. You're investing in the Apple Watch platform.
Yeah, so that happened, and it sucked, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
But with that out of the way, what would you like to know about the new Apple Watch?
So you're upgrading from the previous one, right? The Series 3.
Series 2.
Series 2, all right. So yeah, it's a two generation of worth of upgrades. So what for you has been like the biggest change? Like what makes you go like, wow, when you use this new device? Like what is the killer feature?
Performance.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah it's like a lot faster than the Series 2. It's unbelievable how faster it is. I know compared to the Series 3, it's already faster. Of course, it's a 64-bit processor and stuff. But yeah, compared to the Series 2, it's amazing how much faster it is. It feels like it's 10 times faster.
And I have a Series 0. I wonder how much faster it's going to be for me once I upgrade.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit, yeah. Just barely noticeable, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that from a lot of people, like finally that the Apple Watch feels, you know, that there's no lag, like it just, you can just use it, just like how you can use the iPad or now the iPhone, starting with, you know, since the iPhone 6 or 7, you know, that kind of barrier was broken for the iPhone as well, where it's just like, you just use the device, you don't have to wait for screens to load all the time and things like that.
Yeah, no, you now get the feeling of direct manipulation on the Apple Watch, which was not possible before. When you dragged like the control center or something on the screen, it didn't feel like direct manipulation how we are used to on iPhone. It felt a little bit laggy, and on Series 4, it's like you're doing actually direct manipulation, which is how touch screens are supposed to work on Apple's ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. So how about the screen? Because the screen now goes quote-unquote edge-to-edge, right? So how has that been, like, especially with third-party apps? Has a lot of apps been updated to support that? And how does it feel to have, like, more screen real estate?
So the thing is, we don't use many apps on Apple Watch. Like, and I say we as the collective of Apple Watch users.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone who's got an Apple Watch who's using like tons of apps. You usually have the apps there, but you use the complications. And you only open up the app through the complication to check something real quick, and then you close it. So in terms of apps, all apps I've been using support the Apple Watch Series 4 just fine. My favorite app for Apple Watch is Carrot Weather.
Yeah.
It's the best Apple Watch app I know of.
Uh-huh.
And I use I am currently using the Infograph watch face. It's very opinionated. Many people don't like because it's busy. You can make it look less busy by using less complications, but I actually love having that much information on my wrist. It's really cool. I have the reminders complication on the corner, the calendar one. I have the digital time. I have the calendar in the middle with the date. I have two complications for the Home Runner app, which is it Home Runner or Home Run? I think it's Home Runner. So one of them is to turn on all the lights. So I just tap and it turns on all the lights. And another one is to turn everything off. So when I go to sleep or when I get out of the house or something. So yeah, and I love using the complications, and I think complications is like what makes apps on the watch make sense.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
Yeah, I rarely open the carousel view to actually launch an app. It's very rare for me to do that.
Yeah. And this has got me thinking a little bit, like, you know, when you're building a watch app these days, first of all, you have to bundle it inside of an iPhone app. You have to have an actual like app that you can tap on the home screen of the watch, which has like some form of, you know, usable UI. Do you feel that like the barrier for entry for Apple Watch apps could really be reduced if, say, you could just build just the complication as its own thing? It wouldn't need to have any companion iPhone app. It wouldn't need to have, you know, any UI that you can launch from any home screen. Just say, I would just want to build a complication for weather or for to-do lists or whatever.
Not having an iPhone app would be tricky. The thing I think could work would be to have only the iPhone app. You have like, let's say you have an iPhone app and it's a weather app, and you want to make a complication for the Apple Watch, but you don't want to make an Apple Watch app. You yeah. just want the complication to show like the current temperature and conditions on the watch screen. So I think it should be possible to do that without having an Apple Watch app. Without having an iPhone app, I think that's not feasible with how things work at the moment. But the iPhone app could provide the data for the complication, and maybe the iPhone app could be launched in the background when you tap the complication, which is how things work at the moment. Yeah. But ideally, it would be a standalone extension process on the iPhone responsible for the complication, because then you don't have to run the entire app in the background.
Yeah, exactly.
We've talked about this in length before.
Yeah. This is our dream about the future of iOS architecture in general, right? That everything is these nice modular building blocks that can be individually launched.
Yeah. And currently, as far as I know, the only action that can be done when a complication is tapped is to open the app.
Right.
So, and the app knows about which complication you tapped. So for a home run, when I tap one of the complications, it actually launches the app. But since the app knows the complication I tapped, it can do the action immediately. But then I have to close the app because it opened up the app. And it would be great if it could just do the thing without actually launching the app in the foreground.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of having extensions on the watch itself, right? So mm-hmm. moving the watch to more becoming this kind of sophisticated OS, which can run, you know, extension processes and things like that.
And you can have the launching the app in the background as a fallback, like just so yeah. the developer is not obligated to do like a standalone extension.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I feel in a way that, you know, in the beginning we had the iPhone, and the iPhone in the beginning had to be always paired with a Mac or a Windows PC. So you needed to use iTunes in order to set it up, in order to move data over, and you needed to sync it. You know, remember the good old days when you actually put your iPhone into your Mac every night to sync it? You know, that was a thing. And I feel like the Apple Watch is kind of a little bit like that, but a more like modern take on it. So it still needs the iPhone as its like big buddy. But, you know, just like how the iPhone became completely independent, you know, you don't need to connect it to a Mac at all anymore if you don't want to. I feel like the watch could go there as well. And we could look back at the good old days the same way, where it's like, remember when we needed to always have a companion iPhone app in order to have a watch app. I feel like the watch, you know, in the future could really become this more like standalone device. And I think that would actually make it also a lot more powerful in many ways, because it would be, you know, more possible to build this more interesting experiences where you have like extensions and they can all be separate, and you could run all the apps you could think of just on the watch without having to worry about whether an iPhone is nearby and things like that.
Yeah, and I happen to know that there exists a standalone mode for Apple Watch, which is used internally at Apple, probably by the Apple Watch team, because they probably do lots of testing that don't necessarily require an iPhone.
Yeah.
So there is an Apple Watch can be activated in a standalone mode. Of course, at the moment, it wouldn't do much.
Right.
But there's definitely something in that direction that we can expect in the future.
Yeah, because once it gets powerful enough, it could just run everything on it of its own, right? I mean, the big reason why the iPhone is kind of the brains behind the operation is because the watch has been so slow up until kind of this point. But now it has a dual core CPU, maybe next year it'll have a quad core CPU, maybe a neural engine, and then, you know, we're off to the races.
It's not just about being powerful enough. I think the Series 4 is more than powerful enough to do stuff on its own. It's also about syncing, just so you can sync your data to your iPhone. And also, like, if you don't have an LTE Apple Watch, you can be on the go with your iPhone and it will use the LTE from your iPhone seamlessly.
Yeah, but I feel like that's also something that probably is kind of going away in the future, because just again to make that analogy with the iPhone, in the beginning the iPod Touch was really, really popular and was a really big, you know, device in terms of, you know, the amount of people that were using it. But that device has kind of faded away because now everyone just buys iPhones and everyone has a SIM card and LTE and all those kind of things. And I feel like the non-LTE version of the Apple Watch is kind of like the iPod Touch, where at some point that's probably going to go away, and then we can make the assumption when we're building apps that this is going to be a standalone device, it's going to have its own connection, and it's always going to work. Cool. So another feature, you mentioned it briefly there, that they released a new update of watchOS, and one big feature that was added was the support to take your own ECG on your wrist. So you can kind of carry around a little hospital on your wrist, right? So you've been using this feature, I know. You've been sending me your heartbeats, which is not creepy at all. And tell me more about this, and how is it like to take your own ECG using the Apple Watch?
It's very interesting, and the first time I did it, it really felt like the future.
It's like Star Trek.
Yeah. So they released this feature. It has lots of implications with regulations and stuff. So they have the green lights by the FDA in the US. So the way it works is that, and there was lots of confusion about this, so I think we need to address this. So I had looked before into iOS and watchOS before the 5.1.2 version was released. And just to be clear, there was no ECG app before. There was no trace of the ECG app before the 5.1.2 release. So this was... there was nothing I could look at, but I looked into, I think it was HealthKit, and the availability of the ECG feature was based on the region of the device. So if you have the region set to the US on your device,
right?
And the region currently defines other things, such as the availability of Apple Pay and the TV app and Apple News. So, for instance, my devices are set as the US region, so because I want to get Apple News and stuff like that. But so that was the way it was before they actually released it. And I don't know if my article had anything to do with it. Like, oh, see, this guy here on 9to5 Mac is teaching people how to go around our limitations. So let's put another one in.
Yeah.
I hope not. I think it's just such a serious feature that they really wanted to make sure it was properly, they had their assets properly covered, I guess.
I mean, a big company like Apple, they can't take shortcuts when it comes to these legal things, right? They probably have like an army of lawyers that are deciding, you know, how this can and cannot work. So yeah, that's totally understandable why it was more limited when it actually rolled out.
Yeah, so what they did is they limited it based on where you bought your Apple Watch. So the devices, they have a unique identifier, and they have many unique identifiers, but there's one of them which, based on, I think, the first two digits, the system knows which country that device was meant to be sold on. So, of course, everything is manufactured, at least most of the devices are manufactured in China. Mm-hmm. But when they are manufactured, and I guess when they burn the firmware on the chip, which has this unique identifier, it has the identifier, oh, this is going to go to the US, to be sold in the US. So that's what they are checking. There's no GPS involved. Many people were saying, oh, you need to be in the US. No, there's no GPS, no location, nothing. It's just the unique identifier that can tell the system where the device was sold.
Yeah.
So since my Apple Watch, even the one I got after the first one that came from the US, I have ECG on my Apple Watch.
Nice. That's really cool.
Yeah. So that's how the limitation works.
Yeah, that makes sense, because that's probably also the legal grounds, right? Where if it was technically sold in the US, then it abides by US rules or something like that. I mean, we're not lawyers, but we can imagine that something like that is the case.
Yeah, exactly.
So obviously you can probably not speak to like the accuracy of the actual result of the ECG because, well, you're not a doctor, but you know, how does it look when you're making it? Like, does it feel like a proper thing? Does it feel like something a doctor could give you, this kind of report? Does it have like this kind of information? And yeah, well, do you feel like it's something that could be really useful to you?
Yeah. So disclaimer that I'm not a doctor.
not a doctor.
From my research, when you actually do an ECG on a hospital with a doctor on a clinic or something, they use many wires. So they put wires all over your body and several different places. And each one of those wires is going to collect a different reading. So there are many lines in the ECG with the squiggly wave thing that shows your heartbeat.
I think that's a proper scientific term for it, the squiggly thing.
Yeah, the squiggly wave thing.
In case anyone didn't listen to you when you said you were not a doctor, like that really gave you away.
Yeah, so there are many of those things on a real, quote-unquote, real ECG, because there are several different leads spread around your body, and I guess each one of them can tell something about the condition of your heart rhythm. But the Apple Watch is only one, so because you need a closed circuit to make a connection to actually measure the electrical activity of your heart. So you close the loop by putting your finger on the digital crown, and so that's one lead EKG. It's like one of those leads you do on a real EKG, and it can measure, for instance, if you have atrial fibrillation, which is a common type of arrhythmia in your heart. So that's what they are trying to measure with the EKG on the Apple Watch. And they tested it against the medical EKG, and they came up with a good algorithm and a good calibration and stuff. And there's been at least one public case of a person who's got the AFib diagnosis by the Apple Watch and went to the doctor, and yep, they had AFib.
Wow. Yeah, that's so cool when we're getting into this territory of where these devices can actually help, you know, save lives and help people with medical conditions and even discover medical conditions that they didn't know that they even had. So yeah, that's incredibly powerful.
Yeah, I was kind of the anxious when I did the first one, because I was, oh, will it say something about, maybe I will discover I have a heart problem.
Yeah.
And I'm currently doing it once per day, like at least once per day, just because this is something that does not necessarily happen all the time if you have the condition. It can just appear sometimes. So yeah, so it's cool. You can do it like once or twice per day, and maybe one time it won't show anything and the other it will, and then you have to go to the doctor.
You know what they say, Rambo? An EKG a day keeps a doctor away.
Maybe it brings the doctor closer, because
maybe always have the doctor with you. One thing that's interesting to me about this from a kind of technical point of view, you mentioned earlier that they've been, you know, collecting lots of sample data and they've used that to train a model. And this is interesting to me because it's kind of similar to how computational photography works, where, you know, the lenses on the cameras are not as good as the pictures that come out of them, because they have this complete software layer and machine learning stack in between where we say, you know, here's a picture, let's enhance that based on all this other data that we have of pictures taken with like big, you know, much more capable cameras. And here you have the same kind of situation where you're able to take a quite accurate, as far as we know, EKG on your wrist using just a single source of input on the Apple Watch. And then by augmenting that data with all these other things and this training models and everything, you can get an accurate result. And this kind of way of building systems, this modern way of augmenting traditional kind of algorithms and heuristics with the machine learning programs, I think is incredibly interesting. And it's a great example, I feel, of where we can, you know, take hardware that is less capable, but make it so much more capable based on historic data.
Yes, it's very interesting. And just in case people are curious, I had a look at how they are doing the analysis of the results. There's this new framework on watchOS 5.1.2 called Heart Rhythm Algorithms. So it's a kind of a tongue twister there.
Yeah.
At first, I thought, oh, maybe they're using something like CoreML or machine learning or something. But then I started thinking about it, and spoiler alert, they're not. So then it kind of makes sense for me, because machine learning is kind of unpredictable. And for a given input, it's not necessarily going to always give the same outputs.
It's not a pure function.
Yeah, exactly. So they are actually using algorithms. So it's not machine learning.
But so, probably those algorithms are, you know, obviously they're based on historic data, but they might even have used like machine learning models and things to come up with the input for those algorithms and then, you know, verify those against the control data and things like that.
Yeah, true. And this framework uses the Accelerate framework.
Oh, cool. Nice. That's kind of like a little bit of a precursor to CoreML, but it's CPU bound. Like it's used the CPU instead of using the GPU.
Yeah. Yeah, another disclaimer, I can't say for sure that there's no machine learning involved. I can say that they're not using CoreML.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but it makes sense to what you said also, like to make things more predictable, but probably there's still a lot of like underlying models at work, and there might be like multiple layers, right, to this thing where, you know, maybe a big part is still using like heuristics, but those heuristics might be based on training data that was done offline.
Yeah, that could be the case.
So what more spelunking findings have you found from this new Apple Watch and from the ECG feature?
There's a cool animation.
Oh yeah? There's always a cool animation.
And as you know, when there's a cool animation, there's me looking.
Right.
Maybe I'll write up an in-depth article about it on Remo.codes. I'm not sure there's enough there yet, but yeah, I'm analyzing. So when you open up the EKG app, there's this really beautiful little particle animation, which is kind of shaped like a 3D heart. And when you put your finger on the crown, the particles morph into a grid, which becomes the background for the waveform. And it looks really cool. And if you take your finger off before the reading is done, then the particles dissipate and become a heart again. So it's a beautiful little animation.
Yeah, that's
and,
really cool.
And I was curious to see how they did it. And they used metal.
Awesome. Yeah, that's directly. Amazing. Isn't that super cool that you have this like really low level, powerful GPU, you know, shader based graphics programming tool running on a watch?
Yes. Yeah. And I'm not sure why they decided to go with metal directly, if it's something related to performance, or if it's just like the people who did it preferred to do it this way. Because you have SyncKit on the watch, right?
Yeah, you do. It is SyncKit on the watch is still, you know, a little bit constrained in terms of performance and things like that. So it could be a performance reason why they went with metal. But also, like, just looking at this animation, it's actually a really good fit for something like metal. Like, it's a good just technological fit, because when you are rendering these kind of, you know, procedural graphics effects where you have these particles and things, that's a perfect fit for a shader, where literally that's what you're doing. You're writing functions to compute the different pixel positions and different colors. And, you know, that's perfect for writing something like a particle-based animation.
Nice. Yeah, so they use the right tool for the job there. Yeah, and it's funny like that I said, oh, SceneKit, is SceneKit available on watchOS? But then I just remember that it's Apple. They can do anything.
Exactly. SceneKit can be made available if they want to.
Yeah, no, it's because, and this is interesting about Apple Watch development, and we talked about this before, but many APIs are just marked unavailable on watchOS from an API standpoint, like the SDK will not allow you to use the API, but it's actually available. It is there, but Apple don't want you to use it.
Yeah,
kind of like private APIs, but they are public on like iOS and tvOS, but they are considered private on watchOS.
Right.
Things like UIKit and core animation. You can use core animation on your Apple Watch. I know because I actually wrote a little test app that renders a chibi from Chibi Studio as a core animation thing on Apple Watch.
Oh, that's super cool.
And another one is like AV Foundation. There is AV audio player on Apple Watch, but there's no AV player, which is used to play video. But you can use it. I made an app that's like puts a video full screen on Apple Watch and plays the video and has the time on top. So it could be like a watch face with a video as the background.
Wow, that's really cool. And I do you also think that a big reason for this is because they wanted to maintain the same headers? They didn't want to have to like have a separate set of headers for WatchKit or for WatchOS, but still like they don't consider the APIs ready for public consumption, or they don't want people to use it for like battery reasons and things like that.
It's just like private APIs, like there are APIs which are available on iOS, but are unavailable on tvOS.
Yeah.
So they just mark them as unavailable. So, but the API still exists, but it's unavailable. So Xcode won't let you use it unless you convince it to.
Yeah. All right. So in summary, it sounds like you are very excited about this new device, and it sounds like it's a good product, and especially now with the ECG capabilities and things like that. So what's your kind of final verdict about the Apple Watch? Like, what's the score?
It's a 9 out of 10.
That's good. That's really good.
Yeah, I love it. The screen is great. We didn't talk much about the screen, but it's awesome. And the ECG is also really cool. And I love hacking with it. Like, yeah. You love hacking with the iPad Pro.
Yeah, of course. That's the main benefit of these new devices, right? That we can write cool stuff for them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Awesome. So we have some other piece of news that we want to talk about. And guess what? It is about AirPower. This is very funny to me that we can do so many episodes talking about AirPower when, you know, many other shows and blogs and things, they've just ruled it out as dead, or, you know, it's not coming for a couple of years. But still, here we are, you know, holding up a beacon of hope for AirPower.
If we had a ding like ATP has for Syracuse talking about file systems, it would be me talking about AirPower.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But it will be maybe a zap, like zoom zoom, you know, because of power. So Rambo, tell us, what is this episode's AirPower report?
Yeah, so there's been a patent application by Apple, and I was looking at the patent application published by Patently Apple, very cool website, mm-hmm. And so it looked familiar to me. The stuff they were showing in the patent application. So what they show in the patent application is AirPower, but it's not a patent for AirPower itself, I guess. It's more a patent as to how a device that can charge multiple devices interfaces with the devices being charged and how that is represented in terms of user experience. So basically, they patented the AirPower animation.
But it's a really good animation, right? Maybe it's worth patenting. I don't know. Have you ever written an animation, Rambo, that you felt, oh boy, I'm going to patent this?
And boy, have we patented it.
Like, oh, yeah. Steve Jobs on the first iPhone keynote.
It's classic. Yeah. So how do you feel like this, what do you feel like this says about AirPower? Like, this, of course, could be something that they either just patent because, you know, they patent everything, or it can be something that they did, you know, they started with a long time ago. But do you feel like this is kind of another sign of life for AirPower?
I don't think it says anything about that. I think they patent all kinds of things, even some things that never become a product. So I don't think it has anything to say about that. If you wanted to be optimistic, you could think like, oh, it's because the release is imminent, so it's time for them to patent the design and stuff. But I don't know about that. And it's very funny because I was flipping through the pages of the patent application, and then there's this one which is what looks like an iPhone on top of what looks like an AirPower, and then the little iPhone image inside the iPhone, and then there's this curvy line showing like the iPhone spinning towards the platter where it's where the icon sits after the animation is done. It was like a how can we represent this animation as just a single drawing?
Yeah, and there's so many like constraints also to how these patent applications need to be drawn, right? They need to be drawn in a specific way, and they always look really funny because, you know, there's probably a lot of rules around like, you know, how they can be drawn in order to be enforceable.
Yeah, and there's one little tidbit of information in this patent. And first of all, everything they describe in the patent as to how the interface works for the charging showing up on the largest device with the largest screen, which is charging, and how the animation works and how the different devices show up, it all matches up with the implementation that I know of. They added in iOS 11 and then removed later when they noticed that it was going to be delayed. So it all matches up with reality, I guess. And there's one little detail which I didn't know about, but it looks like it's also implemented, which is after the animation is done and after the little summary of the device's charging is shown, like a list, it collapses down into the battery icon on the corner of the device.
Ooh, and that's cool.
If you tap the battery icon on the device, it shows you, again, the interface.
Oh, nice. Okay, so that's like a little shortcut to show like the current charging status of all the AirPower devices.
Yeah, because you're not going to be using the device while it's charging on AirPower. At least you're not supposed to.
Yeah. Otherwise, you're holding it wrong.
Yeah, so you could like just be looking at your notifications or something, and then if you want to see how the charging is going, you just tap the battery icon on the corner.
Yeah, cool. That sounds really good. And there was something else that you found by spelunking a little bit more, and you have some evidence to suggest that even if AirPower is coming, it is not coming this year. And we're not only talking about that because it's mid-December, so that's that's not the only clue as to why it's not coming this year, but you've also found some evidence of that in code.
Yeah, you could think that the device could be released with the new smart battery cases like in December 19th or something.
Yeah.
But there's this issue that the components responsible for this whole charging UI thing are not present on iOS at the moment.
Right.
They have been removed on iOS 11.4, I think, and they never came back. And there's currently, we are currently on the first beta of iOS 12.1.2. And this first beta does not have the stuff for the charging there. So if they released it now, they would they release it without software support? I don't think so.
Yeah, exactly. And it would also be strange to like interrupt the kind of cycle that they've established with betas and testing in order to, you know, squeeze in a point release that has been unannounced and untested in order to get AirPower support, which, you know, probably is a pretty big thing, especially if it like interacts with system level features like the battery icon and things like that.
Yeah, it's not like I could see they like doing just one beta of the this version of iOS and like releasing it on the 20th, but that would be kind of crazy. It's not impossible, but it would be very weird. So what I think is most likely, if we consider that it's going to be released soon-ish, would be for the release of AirPower to be in like January or something, and the GM version of 12.1.2 includes the UI stuff.
Right,
that
so
would be possible.
All the compiler flags enabled and just like merge that in and yeah. Make it work. Yeah.
Yeah, or maybe it's not that soon, and it's going to come with iOS 12.2 or something, and then it would be like March.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, possible, because there might be like a March event, and then we might see, because there's also a couple of new hardware things that we're waiting for, like new AirPods case and things like that. And yeah, it might make sense for all those things to be like in a separate event or something like that and enable those features at the same time.
Yeah, so I think we are going to see an announcement about AirPower soon, about they not being able to meet their initial 2018 goal of releasing it, because it's not common for them to miss a deadline that they promised and not say anything. They usually say something at the last possible moment. So we could see an announcement maybe this Friday, the 14th, like at the end of the day after the stock market is closed.
All the journalists have gone home for the weekend.
Yeah, or maybe it would be even better for them if they did it on like the 21st, because then it's Christmas Eve and then there's New Year's and then no one is going to pay attention.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's possible. And usually also they wait, if they say something like this, like for example with the Mac stuff, like the Mac Pro, when they had this Mac roundtable, they waited until they had something to announce, until they had like regrouped and reformed their plans, and they said, okay, yeah, we know you're waiting for a Mac Pro, we painted ourselves into this thermal corner in that case, and here's our plan, like here's what we're doing, here's what's coming. And I feel like something similar could happen with AirPower, but they wouldn't just say, oh, sorry, we're delayed. Like they would also say, here's what we're doing and here's the plan.
Yeah. And it's also possible that they are going to not only release AirPower next year, but also their own standalone wireless charger for a single device.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that would be cool. Would that be like a proper Qi charger, or would it still be like using AirPower technology, you think?
Probably both, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe it would be Qi compatible, but it would the iOS would have some special support for it to show something on screen a little bit better than for a regular charger.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Cool. What do you say? Should we round off this episode by doing some Ask Stacktrace questions?
Definitely. Let's do this.
Let's do it. So as you know, if you want to ask us a question for the show, you can just tweet with the hashtag AskStackTrace. And you don't have to tweet at any specific account or anything like that. Just tweet out into the open Twitter with the hashtag AskStackTrace. And we're going to pick that up for a future episode. So our first question comes from Chris. And Chris wants to know a little bit more about entitlements. What are they and how do they work? Private versus public entitlements, and how can you use something like Tacky in order to check entitlements?
Yeah, so I actually had to do some research about what Tacky is. So Tacky is spelled T-A-C-C-Y, and it's an app that lets you see something about the entitlements of an app on macOS. But it's not a very good tool if you want to look at entitlements. And I think the person who asked this question, Chris, I think he's confusing a little bit entitlements with permissions. So let's dig into this. So entitlements are a way on all Apple's platforms for the system to prevent unauthorized apps from doing something.
And unauthorized things.
Yeah, and this something can be anything, like accessing your calendar. That's a very clear privacy situation there that you want to be able to authorize or not authorize an app. But there are other types of entitlements, such as the entitlement that lets an app talk to Siri and integrate with a Siri kit and stuff. And that entitlement does not involve any user interaction. The user does not have to give the app permission, but the app needs to have that entitlement. The same goes for remote notifications. Of course, you need to authorize apps to send you alerts, but there are silent notifications which an app can receive, which the user does not have to allow the app to receive. So that's another type of entitlement. And I'm just giving them as examples, but there are like thousands of entitlements that an app can have. If it's an Apple app, there is a more limited number of entitlements that a developer app can have.
Yeah.
And the entitlements are baked into the app's code signature. So there's no way for you to fake an entitlement on iOS if your device is not jailbroken. So it's a very secure way for the system to prevent apps from doing stuff they shouldn't do.
Yeah, because as the OS is kind of decrypting the app, if you will, like as it's using its own certificate to actually run the code, it can also, based on that, determine what entitlements the app has. So it's not like some files that are baked in that you could, you know, do some tricky thing to just replace those binaries or something like that, or shift the bytes. You actually need, you know, it needs to be part of the code signature in order for the system to pick it up.
Yeah, it's cryptographically guaranteed that if an app has an entitlement, it has been given by Apple on iOS. On the Mac, there are things you can do, such as disabling SIP and disabling AMFID, so you can do anything on the Mac, which is fun. Yeah. So I have on my non-pro machine, I have disabled MFID and SIP. So MFID is the system that checks the integrity of entitlements and stuff like that. I'm simplifying here, but that's what it does. And with it disabled, you can sign your app with invalid entitlements, and the system is going to be happy with you. So one example that is related to the ECG thing we talked about, which I did some research yesterday, there is an entitlement which is called com.apple.developer.healthkit. And this is the entitlement that a developer can add to their app to be able to interface with HealthKit, be it reads health data, writes health data. This also involves user consent, but the app needs to have this entitlement.
Yeah.
And there's another entitlement which is called com.apple.private.healthkit. And this is an entitlement that only Apple can have on their apps, which gives access to other HealthKit stuff, private HealthKit stuff.
Right, more like under the hood data and like a raw database access and things like that, maybe.
Such as access to the ECG recording feature.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I looked into how the ECG app works on watchOS, and it has the com.apple.private.healthkit entitlement. And it uses HealthKit, and there's like an electrocardiogram session, and it just records an electrocardiogram using... It's a very simple, beautiful API, but me as a developer, I can't use it on an app I make. Even if it's just running from Xcode, it won't let me sign an app with the com.apple.private.healthkit entitlement. That's not possible.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So... I hope this gave an idea of what entitlements are, what you can do with the app Tacky. If you are on the Mac, you can open other apps with it, and it's going to tell you about the entitlements an app has in relation to permissions for privacy-sensitive data, such as calendar, photos, camera, and stuff. So it's interesting. It's still good for people to be able to see this information. I even think maybe Finder could have this info for people. But yeah, there you go. That's a a very complicated explanation about entitlements.
Yeah. Yeah, these things are pretty complex. And even as an iOS developer in the beginning, like getting your head around what these entitlements are and why you get some kind of obscure error where you can't load a framework or you can't, you know, register for push notifications and things like that. But yeah, it often comes down to entitlements. And now we have this nice UI in Xcode where you can check like, oh, I want push notifications, I want CloudKit, I want HealthKit, I want this and that. And it's more like a buffet of entitlements, right? But yeah, under the hood, that's kind of how they work. They make this kind of cryptographic signature like you mentioned. And it's a really cool system, I feel like, also to you know, really segment parts of the system and parts of the data that the user has, and also enabling Apple to kind of manage those permissions with the entitlements to give apps like runtime access to your photos or to your health data and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, for the developers who are listening, when you mess with the capabilities pane in Xcode on your project, you're basically enabling or disabling entitlements.
Yeah, exactly. All right, our next question here comes from Vadim. And Vadim wants to know how we work with Git, which is a version control system that most developers use when building apps. And the question is, do we prefer the command line or do we prefer UI-based tools? So for me, I use a combination of both. I use the command line for most of my things when it comes to version control. I push and pull and do everything like rebasing and merging and all those kind of things on the command line. And the reason for that is that I've learned Git now after being a developer for quite a while well enough that I feel like I can use it and it's not a problem for me. And it feels quicker for me to do everything on the command line rather than having to launch some app and navigate the app. It's just quicker for me to type a command on the command line. And this is like a recommendation in general. Like if you feel like Git is like really complicated and you feel like you like have to use a very, you know, complex app for it, it's worth, I feel like, to spend some time with Git on the command line to learn how it works under the hood, because it will help you to resolve so many issues that can occur when you're merging and you get conflicts and things like that. There's just one thing I use a UI-based tool for, and that is, or two things actually, staging and conflict resolution. So for that, I use GitX. It's an open source app, which we can put a link to in the show notes, that I use for staging. And then for merging files when it comes to conflicts, I used to use the built-in, I think it's called File Merge, the built-in app for that that comes with the Mac. So yeah, that's my way of working with Git. Most of the tasks I do on the command line, and then I use UI tools for staging and for conflict handling.
I just use the command line, and for merging, I use Visual Studio Code.
Oh, that's cool. All right. It has a built-in merging tool as well, right?
Yeah, and it's really good.
Nice. I should try that out. Yeah, that's awesome. Cool. Our next question comes from Dylan, and Dylan wants to know what our window layout usually looks like when we're working with Xcode and the simulator. So how do you place Xcode and how do you place the simulator like perfectly on the screen in order to be the most productive Rambo?
I rarely use the simulator. I think we mentioned it before.
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk about my desk and my window setup. So
right, your physical window setup.
Yeah, so I have the elevation dock to my right, close to the screen of my MacBook Pro with the iPhone I'm testing with attached. And when I'm just writing code, I have just the code part of Xcode on screen, and I make it feel like I leave a little bit of padding to the sides, so it doesn't, it's not too much to the left. So that's basically how I do it. I don't fill the entire screen with the code window, just like, I don't know, two-thirds maybe a little bit more than that.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. So you want to be able to see like the desktop and access it quickly, or what's the reason for not filling it completely?
It's just because I feel more comfortable that way. Like, okay. I don't like having
an artistic choice.
I don't like having to look to the left to see the start of a line of code.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that makes sense. Cool. For me, I mostly run Xcode in full screen, and there's this flag that you can enable. I don't have it, you know, ready here off the top of my head, but we can put a link in the show notes to a tweet I made about how to enable that. And it basically enables you to run Xcode in full screen and also run the simulator on the side in full screen. So you can use macOS's split screen feature where you put simulator on the right, Xcode on the left, and it's all running in full screen. And this comes back to our earlier discussion about me like wanting to always hack my productivity. And I feel like by using full screen mode and really immersing myself in my code when I'm writing it, I feel like I am less distracted and more productive. So that's how I prefer to use Xcode.
I don't think you need a command anymore as of Xcode 10.
Oh, maybe it's enabled
Xcode
now.
10.
Okay, yeah, that might be true, yeah. I've just been using it for a while, so yeah, it might be enabled by default now. Yeah, that's right.
Don't email us.
Awesome. So that's our final question for this episode. Thank you so much again to everyone who sends in questions to this show. Again, you can just tweet with the hashtag AskStackTrace and we'll pick up your question for a future episode. But for now, this is the end of this episode and actually also a little bit of the end of this first season of StackTrace. Because we're going to take a little bit of a holiday break over the holidays and New Year's Eve, and we'll be back again with this show early next year.
Earlier than AirPower.
So stay subscribed, stay tuned. You can follow us on Twitter. We are at StackTracePod on Twitter, where we'll announce when our season 2 premiere will be. And of course, you can also find Rambo. He is at _inside. I am at JohnSundell on Twitter. Thank you so much to all of our wonderful patrons who are helping us support us doing this show every month and who also joins our monthly after shows, which is a lot of fun to do. But until next year and next time, say happy holidays and happy new year, Mr. Rambo.
Happy holidays and happy new year.